w skład Rady wchodzi sto kilkadziesiąt osób ze wszystkich państw europejskich, osób wybitnych również z Polski. Przy okazji posiedzenia Rady Fundacji, posiedzenia zarządu Rady, postanowiliśmy zorganizować tę pierwszą debatę i wybraliśmy temat bardzo ogólny, dlatego że w Polsce, ale nie tylko w Polsce i w innych krajach, jak się mówi o polityce zagranicznej, zazwyczaj uwaga jest skoncentrowana na problemach w stosunku danego kraju ze światem otaczającym. I to jest również prawdą, jeżeli chodzi o Polskę. Mówi się o sąsiadach, mówi się o Unii Europejskiej, o stosunkach ze Stanami Zjednoczonymi. Rzadko się mówi o polityce całej Unii Europejskiej i rzadziej jeszcze się mówi o problemach świata. Zaproponowałem ten bardzo ambitny temat jako właśnie początek, bo mi się wydaje, że zaletą naszej Rady, która stara się wyjść poza opłotki narodowe, tylko przygotowywać to, co jest na razie duchem w poszukiwaniu wcielenia, to znaczy wspólnej polityki europejskiej, chcielibyśmy właśnie rozpocząć debatę, której centrum nie będą interesy narodowe, chociaż oczywiście one znajdą, przypuszczam, miejsce w naszych wystąpieniach panelistów, tylko o problemach Europy i o problemach świata dzisiejszego. No, mamy wybitnych uczestników, których nazwiska Państwa widzieli w ogłoszeniach. To są wszystko członkowie naszej Rady, Europejskiej Rady Polityki Międzynarodowej. No, chciałbym przywitać przede wszystkim pana ministra Radosława Sikorskiego. Chciałbym przywitać serdecznie naszego współprzewodniczącego naszej Rady, Martti Ahtisaari, byłego prezydenta Finlandii, laureata Nagrody Nobla, współprzewodniczącego naszej Rady. Finlandia, przepraszam. Finlandia od wielu lat robi swoistą karierę w polskich debatach publicznych jako przykład, fascynujący przykład awansu, niesłychanego awansu cywilizacyjnego, utożsamianego zazwyczaj z Nokią. Otóż Martti Ahtisaari jest drugim produktem eksportowym najbardziej znanym w Europie. I'm sorry, I didn't say it. Tim, can you translate, Martti? Poza tym mamy trzech bardzo wybitnych specjalistów, analityków, myślicieli europejskich, którzy zajmują się problemami polityki zagranicznej. No, najbardziej z nich znany w Polsce od lat 30. Timothy Garton-Ash, profesor z Oxfordu. Który zaczął swoją wielką karierę intelektualną i polityczną, myśliciela politycznego, od książki na temat Solidarności. Myślę, że do dziś najlepszej książki o Solidarności. Później pisał bardzo wiele o Niemczech, o Europie, o świecie, prawda? Coraz bardziej awansowo, nie wiem zresztą, czy to jest awans, czy to nie jest awans, ale w każdym razie jego perspektywa coraz bardziej się rozszerzała. Ostatnio napisał znakomity artykuł o Bliskim Wschodzie w Europie, czyli problem imigrantów z Bliskiego Wschodu do Europy. Iwan Krastev, który od wielu lat jest częstym bardzo gościem na łaman naszych pism, gazet, jest jednym z najwybitniejszych myślicieli, intelektualistów naszej części Europy, uczestnikiem wszystkich wielkich debat na temat polityki zagranicznej, które toczą się teraz w skali globalnej. I wreszcie Mark Leonard, który tak naprawdę kieruje nami, naszą Radą, jest wybitnym brytyjskim myślicielem, analitykiem stosunków międzynarodowych, który stał się bardzo znany dzięki książkom o Europie, o Chinach, pisał znakomite teksty o Rosji i nie wymienię wszystkich regionów świata, o których on pisał. Proszę Państwa, przygotowałem sobie, mówiąc prawdę, notatki wstępne, które posłałem dyskutantom, ale uważam, że ważniejsze jest to, co powiedzą uczestnicy uczestnicy naszego panelu. Wobec tego to krótkie moje zaganienie bym zakończył. And I would like to ask you now, Mr. Minister, to start our as an introduction to our debate.
The president will start.
The president, yeah, of course, you are right. Can you, Marty, open our debate? I'm very sorry.
Alexander, thank you very much for your introduction. I was actually rather pleased when you mentioned that I came after Nokia, because the Peter Ahtisaari works for Nokia. It's my son. He's a senior vice president for design in Nokia, so a bit of commercial may be allowed to start with. I have been asked to make a few opening remarks. First of all, I would like to bring greetings from Finland, which is even colder than Poland is. We hit 41.8 minus degrees in the northern part of my country, and it's at least 20 in Helsinki when I left. Yes, thank you. As I said, I was asked to say a few words about the European Council on Foreign Relations, how it came about. There were a number of us who felt rather strongly that something should be done to make EU even more effective than it was at the time when we met and started discussing that what was missing in Europe was European Council on Foreign Relations. And first of all, I was asked to share a commission that would have produced a report. And I said, look, we have enough of these commission reports which no one reads. So can't you think of anything better? So soon after consultation, the idea emerged that no, we didn't need commission that would have produced a report. What we needed was a permanent European Council on Foreign Relations. Many of us had been working in the United States and seen how the American Council on Foreign Relations works, and we felt that something of that sort was needed in Europe too. We very quickly agreed on principles, the statement on principles, which all of us who joined in the beginning and thereafter have accepted. And I read you those. Please bear with me. They are not that many. There are five altogether. There's a preface, first of all, that we call on the governments of European Union to develop a more coherent and vigorous foreign policy informed by our shared values, dedicated to the pursuit of our common European interest and sustained by European power. We endorse the following principles. First, when faced by the great powers of the day and the rising giants of tomorrow, individual European countries regard the world as beyond their control. But if it speaks with one voice, the European Union can help shape the world order. Second, it is only by acting together that European Union countries can effectively pursue their common interest, from combating climate change to reducing poverty, from defending human rights and averting genocide to stopping the spread of deadly weapons and addressing the causes of violent extremism. Three, the European Union's foreign policy should be backed up with all of Europe's economic, political, cultural, and as last resort, military power. Our commitment to strong and effective multilateral institutions must be matched by a drive to increase European influence within them. Four, starting with the European Union neighbors, the best way to secure peace and prosperity is to honor existing commitments to countries seeking membership and to encourage political reforms with more generous offers of economic opportunity and political cooperation. And last, fifth, European transformative power can reach beyond its immediate neighborhood. The European Union should leverage the world's largest single market and the most generous aid budgets to promote the values we believe in, both in other parts of the world and in multilateral institutions. Europeans will benefit from having a stronger voice in the world, and the world will benefit from a stronger European Union. Now, this was some 3 years ago when these principles were adopted. I think all of us can stop and think, where are we today? When it comes to the European Council on Foreign Relations, we have, in this period of existence, we have established our presence in some of the European capitals, in Berlin, London, Madrid, Paris, Rome and Sofia. Our plan is, and that's one of the reasons why we are here, but not the only one, but one of the reasons why we are here today, because we are planning to open an ECFR office in Warsaw this spring, and our strategic partner will be Stefan Batory Foundation. And I'm very pleased that we can announce this opening later on this spring, hopefully well before the Polish president is in EU starts. If we look at the world today, and I'm not going to say much more than I have already said, few words about where we are in the Council at the moment. We have a pan-European Council with slightly over 100 members. They include politicians, decision makers, thinkers and business people from EU countries and from the candidate countries for that matter. And we have a well-functioning research program which is shared by Mark Leonard, our colleague who was introduced to you already. And I think we are very proud about what has been achieved by the Council so far, because in the comparative studies that are carried out by different organizations in the world, ECFR has done well. It was introduced not so long ago, I think it was last year, as the best new think tank that had appeared in the international scene. And I saw a recent one where it did feature very well. So, but then it's one thing that ECFI is featuring well, but then of course we have to see how is the EU doing, because that's why we established that. And instead of going, I'm tempted to start talking about complicated world and what should be done. I think we are living in a very interesting time with the fiscal crisis and the organization of EU in a totally new way that it has been functioning before. But I had a pleasure last year attend a luncheon with President Van Rompuy in Brussels. And perhaps one of the messages I gave to him, because we tend to be extremely negative. What can we do? I mean, do we really have a role? Have we lost our influence entirely? I couldn't help telling him, listening to the comments of my colleagues who attended the same luncheon, that, ladies and gentlemen, tell me who is doing well in today's world? The Americans? The Russians? If you go along, you may say that the Chinese are doing economically well, but they are also seeing what it means to be economically successful, and with increased responsibility, they realize that they have a great responsibility in their own neighborhood, what happened or has been happening in the North Korea, for instance. And they are starting to play a responsible role in trying to solve this sort of issues. So, let's not be altogether desperate about where we can go. I think the problems are sometimes useful. I remember when I became president in Finland in 1994, we had a total mess in our hands. Unemployment was extremely high. But during that 6 years that I was in the office, not because of my presidency, but because of the efforts of my governments, during that period, the unemployment was halved during those 6 years. So, these are the challenges. World is more complicated. It's not a unipolar anymore. Whether it's a multipolar or whether, as some people say, that we have no poles at all at the moment. But perhaps this discussion that hopefully emerges among us, and hopefully with you as well, we can come with some answers to the problems that are facing us, including the ones that have emerged in the recent days whenever we open the TV and see what is happening in North Africa and in the Middle East and in the wider area in that part of the world. But that's all what I wanted to say. I'm thankful that you have all joined us tonight here. And I particularly value that the students are here. I understand that this is your first day. Well done.
Thank you, Mr. President. Teraz poproszę o zabranie głosu pana ministra Radosława Sikorskiego. Ze względu na szacunek dla naszych gości będzie on się wypowiadał po angielsku. Bardzo proszę.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've done my homework and I read your brilliant article over the weekend with the title that anticipates our discussion this evening. And I was particularly struck by a quote from a friend of ours, Gideon Rachman, in the Financial Times, which I shall have to translate back into English, which says, Europe has made the right choice. Let the United States be a military superpower. Let China be an economic superpower, and let Europe be a superpower in the area of lifestyle. Europe can remain the continent of beautiful cities, the best food and wine, the richest cultural heritage, the longest holidays, and the best football teams. The life of the majority of Europeans has never been so good. Sounds wonderful, but unfortunately, in the real world, it doesn't last. History is replete with examples of rich and comfortable nations and cultures being conquered, either internally or externally, by more ruthless, albeit less sophisticated, societies. It is said that demography is destiny. And if that's so, then we have to resign ourselves to the proposition that our relative power in the world is going to diminish. And power is always measured in relative terms, because power is by comparison with others. So even if our population, our European population, stabilizes at perhaps a somewhat lower level than today in the years and decades to come, that will not address the demographic tsunami that we have rising up on the other side of the Mediterranean and in what used to be called the Third World. So what I see as the challenge for us Europeans is, how do you maintain our power and wealth with an older and relatively smaller population by comparison with the rest of the world? And I would argue that it can be done, but it would require bold action on our part. I'm sure many of you read the brilliant book by by Professor Kennedy in the 1980s, whose central thesis was that powers rise and fall, and they generally fall because of imperial overstretch. And the title was the Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And he analyzed Rome, the British Empire, empires of the past. And the one thing I think that he didn't anticipate, and it's, I think, an understandable mistake, because in the old days, military expenditure truly was the major state expenditure, and therefore, if you were going to get overstretched, it was going through overspending on the military. But that is no longer the case. The biggest budgets in modern countries are not military budgets. They are social budgets. So what I would put to you is that the overstretch that we are suffering from today is not a military overstretch. It's a social overstretch. We have borrowed too much to have the kind of good life that I've just discovered, and we have borrowed against the income of future generations. There was a wonderful saying I learned when I lived in Washington with reference to you here: blessed are the young, for they shall inherit the national debt. And so I put to you that the debate that we are having in Poland right now about the pension system is exactly the right debate to have. It's a very serious business of how you share the rights and obligations between today's pensioners and future pensioners, and how you balance that against the needs of today's state budgets and the ability to pay your way and to modernize for the future. That is a debate that most countries in Europe should have, and if they avoid it, they do so at their peril. Another debate that we need is on energy. And I'm very glad to say that the European Union has taken seriously what Poland started saying about 5 years ago. When we started talking 5 years ago about energy security, it was regarded as an instance of Polish paranoia about Russia. It was regarded as quaint and exotic. Today, the European Commission and the European directives speak our language. We already have pretty good regulations about energy diversification. We now need to put them into practice. And I'm very glad that Poland is the country which has concluded the first agreement with Russia, with an external supplier, but it happens to be Russia, based on Europe's third energy package, with third-party access to gas pipelines and with all kinds of things that hopefully will make the European energy market more competitive and therefore the whole system more secure. But I'm a great believer in politics of doing not what you need to negotiate with others, but doing first and above all what is under our own control. And what is under our own European control is the way we create the internal European energy market and the physical interconnectors that we build between member countries so that we can help one another in crisis. And that's starting to happen. So this second challenge to Europe's wealth and future security is being addressed. And then, of course, we have events in our neighborhood. First, Belarus, which has now been somewhat covered up by events in the Middle East, and revolutions in Tunisia, Egypt, and now Libya. In this part of the world, we know that not all revolutions bring progress, bring better outcomes. But these events at least create the hope that that demographic tsunami that I was talking about will find an outlet into development, into greater opportunity in the countries where those tens of millions of young people actually live. Because the alternative is that they will come here and we will not be able to cope. People and goods travel to where they command a higher price. And they command a much higher price here. But we have also learned that immigration, particularly from culturally incompatible countries, is not a free good. It's very tempting to think that by opening up the gates, allowing all those young people to come and work here, we solve our own social, budgetary and demographic problems. We don't. We just delay them because they will become pensioners too. So it's not a solution. The solution is to create conditions where they live for those countries. And here I think Europe can be part of the solution. And here I'm reinforced in my basic instincts and in what we've been saying inside the EU over the last few years. Namely, that it's a bit of an illusion to expect Europe, which doesn't often treat its own external policy seriously, it's a bit much to expect the United States, China, India, and others to treat us more seriously than we treat ourselves. But where we do have a great deal of influence, where we can affect events, the area which we can reshape in our own image is our neighborhood. Because in the neighborhood, we play to our advantages. Our advantages are that people in our neighborhood, be it in the east or in the south, would like to have the kind of life that we've enjoyed and that they see on their television screens and that they aspire to. And we offer an attractive civilizational model. And more than that, we actually have procedures, institutions, and resources to affect the situation in their own countries. I've been arguing to Cathy and to my colleagues that we should go beyond the culture of negotiating all these association agreements and this over-legalistic basis on which the European Union is founded. I believe that with reference to countries that do good or bad things, we should start behaving like a proper empire and start to grant privileges. In other words, instead of getting involved in five-year negotiations, say, with Belarus over reducing visa fees, which is risible. You know, it's something I've done with one signature, abolished visa fees for Belarus. Why don't we do that as Europe for Schengen visas? We can afford it. It'll cost us a few million euros. We should do it as a one-sided gesture, as a privilege, because we say so. And similarly with trade concessions. We can afford to extend free trade privileges to some of the very poor countries in our neighborhood when they do things that we approve of. And that means, of course, privileges can be withdrawn when bad things happen. We should start being less apologetic about using our resources to political ends that we find desirable. And lastly, I'm also reinforced in what Poland has been proposed in the security area. We are a loyal member of NATO, and Poland has always been a good Atlanticist, but we know that the United States will not be able to sustain the current levels of military expenditure for very much longer. They've just passed the biggest defense budget in its history, just at a time when their debts are their biggest in history. They'll have to start reducing. And Poland, Europe, is much better off with two insurance policies rather than one. Secondly, if we are to have a serious diplomacy and a serious foreign policy, Well, that sometimes needs to be backed up by force. We can't be in this position of being the peer of the world without being a player. In other words, someone who can, a power, the largest economy on earth, who can sometimes force outcomes, at least in our neighborhood. At the very least, we must not allow the repeat of the Balkans in the 1990s, that we have to call upon the United States or other external powers to sort out our immediate neighborhood. And therefore, I believe that Poland's priority in our presidency to strengthen Europe's security and defense policy is the right thing to do. I rest my case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Minister. And now Timothy Gartnasz, please, has the floor.
Dziękuję bardzo. Cieszę się bardzo, że jestem znów na tej sali, gdzie byłem pierwszy raz ponad 30 lat temu i w różnych dramatycznych sytuacjach. Ale jednak staram się mówić po angielsku, bo inaczej inni paneliści mnie chyba nie rozumieją.
To jest jedyny powód.
Well, frankly, if you applaud me for that, that's a pretty good start. listen, I want to say essentially just three things about Europe in the wider world and the work of the European Council on Foreign Relations. The first is a piece of history. Painting with a broad brush, I think one could say that for roughly half a century, from the early 1950s, the European project was essentially about ourselves. It was about relations within the historical and cultural geographical frontiers of Europe, reconciliation between old enemies, reconstruction, the liberation first of Spain and Portugal and Greece from their dictatorships and then of Central and Eastern Europe and Southeastern Europe, and what I don't hesitate to call the reunification of Europe in the great enlargement of the 1st of May 2004. I put it to you that for the next half century, the European project will be mainly about not what we do among ourselves, between ourselves, but what we do at and beyond the historical and cultural frontiers of Europe. Of course, there are still major tasks inside our borders, remaining competitive, creating employment, the environment, adapting to immigration. But even those challenges, when you analyze them, have an ever larger external component. How do you talk about jobs without talking about the emerging economies? How about the environment without talking about global warming? Immigration is itself, as the minister just mentioned, a problem that originates beyond our shores. So that, and that's not to mention the fact that we are experiencing one of the great historical shifts, not just of contemporary history, but of modern history, which is the renaissance of Asia, the reemergence in particular of India and China as the great powers they once were. So that we are moving into not just a post-American but a post-Western world in which the relative power, not just of Europe but of the West as a whole, will be less. And as the minister rightly said, power is relative. And therefore, we have to get our act together to defend our own vital national interests. Even the largest European power, that is to say Germany, will be a dwarf in the world of giants into which we are entering. No area in the world has such a great gulf between its potential power and its actual power. The potential of Europe, the largest economy in the world, the largest aid donor in the world, having the largest diplomatic service put together in the world, and you can go on, is enormous. The actual is often pathetic. And that is why, for me, the pursuit of a genuinely European foreign policy is the great cause of this decade. As for me, the liberation of Eastern Europe was the great cause of the 1980s, the unification of Europe the great cause of the 1990s. This is the great cause of this decade. And the European Council on Foreign Relations, ladies and gentlemen, is not just any old think tank. It's not a talking shop. It is devoted to a single strategic purpose, the formation and promotion of a more united European foreign policy. That is our goal. It didn't, I think, Chairman, quite emerge in your translation. I mean, maybe we should try for another translation of European Council on Foreign Relations, because what it really is the Europejska Rada dla Europejskiej Polityki Zagranicznej. That's what it really means. Second point. If we want a European foreign policy, how will it be made? It will not just be made by having someone called a high representative in Brussels and an external action service. That is a necessary but not a sufficient condition. A European foreign policy requires two elements: effective institutions and an effective high representative, which one day we shall achieve, on the one hand, and on the other, strategic coalitions of willing and able member states. Nothing will be achieved significantly in any area without the combination of those two elements. When you have them, the strategic coalition and the institutions, something happens. When you don't, you don't. This brings me to my third point, which is about Poland, as you know, a country about which I care deeply. Poland clearly has the potential to be one of the big six in the European Union and in EU foreign policy. And I would say that in the few years since Poland joined the EU, it has gone a long way to do a part of that, particularly in the very significant impact Poland has had in EU thinking about the Eastern neighborhood, Ukraine, Belarus, and others, energy policy, energy security, and to some extent Russia. Starting, by the way, with the EU reaction to the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, which in effect was made in Poland, let's be frank. And I'd like to pay tribute also to the current government of Poland and to the foreign minister who's with us today for their contribution, again, in shaping EU policy in these areas, which has been very significant. But to be really effective, there's another element which is needed, which is this. EU foreign policy cannot be just about every major member state trying to upload into EU foreign policy its own particular concerns. So it cannot be that the Poles talk only about Ukraine, the Spanish only about Morocco, the Brits only about America, and the Italians only about Berlusconi, but that's a different story. It has to be the case that Britain also has something to say about Eastern policy, that Spain has something to say about Ukraine or Belarus, and that Poland has something to say about Morocco and the Maghreb, where, as we speak, the most extraordinary events are happening. We can discuss about whether it's rightly called an Arab 1989 or not, but it's certainly something very remarkable. We could perhaps talk in this panel a bit more about how exactly that works, that interaction between, so to speak, the policy that you have to your immediate neighborhood, your prime concerns, and the policies other have towards them and vice versa. But some such interaction is needed. In other words, Spain has to have something to say about Belarus, and Poland has to have something to say about Morocco. And by the way, I would say to what the minister just said, I think the challenge, which you rightly mentioned, of a neighbourhood policy towards the south as well as the east, is in one respect significantly more difficult, not just because of economics or demography, because at the end of the day, there is for Ukraine and Belarus the prospect of EU membership. And I tell you here today in this room that one day the Ukraine and Belarus will be members of the European Union. But I would not take any bets on Morocco or Algeria or Tunisia. In fact, Morocco is the one country that has actually been refused permission to apply to join the EU on the grounds, quote, that it's not a European country, right? How you craft a neighborhood policy for an area where you don't have that great beckoning, warm, safe house of EU membership at the end of the road, and you in Poland know how important that was, is a very difficult challenge. The other challenge, of course, is what I mentioned, the relations with the existing and emerging great powers. And I have to tell you, if you want to see the EU looking at its absolute worst, look at it from Beijing, Moscow, or Washington. You see us at our worst, weak, divided, and hypocritical. That's how we look from the capitals of the great powers. And for us to have a common Russia policy, a common China policy, in the end a common America policy, that requires an even greater effort of strategic coordination, particularly between the major powers of the EU. So this, ladies and gentlemen, is what we in ECFR are hoping to contribute to. I personally am absolutely delighted we're going to have an office here in Warsaw because, as I say, I think Poland is crucial to this endeavor, and we hope working with you, we will be able to create a strategic culture in Europe in which, at last, Europe will punch not below its weight as it does at the moment, but at least at its weight. Thank you very much.
Ivan, the turn is yours.
Thank you very much. First, you don't expect from me to tell you that Bulgaria is planning to lead the European Union in any direction. And it's even not the problem of size. I know that Nokia basically has this slogan, connects people. If you're reading papers in Bulgaria, corruption connects people. But it comes, and I do believe this is part of one thing that ECFR is quite important, and this is that even countries that are not going to lead the European Union are living there. And there is one major crisis which I do believe that we are slightly underestimating, and this is the crisis of European imagination. Or let's make it kind of very clear, and this goes very much in the way we have been talking about. I do believe that we are now seeing a shift that could be very dramatic from Europe that was confident about itself to Europe that starts to fear the future. There was this global survey being done by Gallup International, which shows that everything that we loved, we start to fear now. Globalization, the future. If you're asking Europeans, do you hope for the future or fear the future, you're going to have majorities of Europeans who fear the future. And you're going totally the opposite results in places like China, for example, or even some smaller country with not so spectacular economic growth. I'm saying this because I do believe that the major challenge that Europe is facing today is a shift from a continent which has been governing by democratic imagination to a continent that is going to be driven by demographic imagination. And the difference is that democracy is about how you can change other. Demographic imagination is very much shaped by the fears how others are going to shape you. And from this point of view, even the reaction to the Middle East political revolutions is very interesting. If you look, and I'm not a specialist on the Middle East, there are two things that strike me immediately. The first is you're not going to see American or European flags neither being waved nor being burnt. It's not about us, it's about them. And secondly, you are going to see after the first two or three days of excitement when people have been comparing with 1989, immediate shift to the problem of the immigration. Immediate shift. In a certain way, it's much more fierce than any hopes that are shaping our imagination. I'm saying this because from this point of view, European Council of Foreign Relations, in my view, is facing a challenge which not many talk about. Relative decline, it's fine. You cannot rise all the time. But the basic problem is European Union is not so much facing decline, but a choice to become a retired power. There is a difference between being declining and being retired. Retirement is a matter of choice. You decided not to be involved. You're deciding basically to maximize comfort over basically any type of involvement. You're deciding to frame the questions in the way you are sure that you have nothing to do with them. So from this point of view, European Union really risks to turn into the global political commentator. We have an opinion about everything that is happening in the world. We even can put money here and there, but we don't believe that we have anything to do with the world. And this trend is very much also in our domestic politics. And I do believe it has a lot to do with the demographic changes. In 30 years, more than 30% of the population of Europe is going to be older than 65. This is important, even in psychological terms. And I do believe from this point of view, and this is my second point, is European Union cannot play any global role if it is not a functional regional power. If European Union is not going to be effective in Europe, nobody is going to take European Union seriously. Nevertheless, of how strong our economies are and how much our aid packages are. And from this point of view, going very bluntly, I do believe from this point of view, European Union is facing four very simple problems. And this is how to stay together. Because even taking European Union for granted, in my view, is something that should not be done. How to stay together and to be effective player in a situation in which the geostrategic importance of Europe is going to decline. And at the same time, we should try to manage three very difficult processes. One is Russia's decline over mid and long term. Secondly, probably Turkish ascendancy. And thirdly, America's partial withdrawal from the European continent. And I do believe all these three are very problematic because all three of them are affecting not simply the interests but the very existence of the European Union. And this is where I do believe, and this is going to be my last point, one of the things that very much is going to affect European foreign policy is also how we talk about this. Coming from a small country, very much in the periphery, and also being somebody who was 24 years old in 1989, I always remember in the 1980s the old communist discourse that is trying to trivialize and normalize everything that is happening in the world. This is this type of a political correctness which does not make meaning to anybody, but you are afraid to say anything meaningful because you fear the panic much more than the real problem. I do believe that there is a lot of trivialization and normalization which are now in the current European foreign policy discourse. There are real crises, there are real problems, and there are real choices to be made. But in order for this to be done, I do believe we should change the nature of European debate about foreign policy. And I do believe this is one of the ambitions of the European Council. Thank you.
And Mark Leonard, please.
What's left to say after these incredible presentations? I want to delve a bit deeper into two things. One is this, what I think is a triple power transition, which has shaken the world. The pieces are in the air. The kaleidoscope has been shaken in Tony Blair's phrase. But I don't think the pieces have landed yet. And I think for Europe in particular, and for countries like Poland and my own country, Britain, it's particularly confusing. And so I want to talk a bit about this triple power transition, which is affecting the world, the European neighbourhood, and the EU itself. And secondly, I want to talk a bit about the changing nature of power in the 21st century and what that means for Europe. So I'll start with this power transition. a lot of the trends have already appeared in other people's remarks. I won't go into any detail in them, but I think we are seeing at a global level that we're living in a post-Western world, as people have pointed out, and what's most troubling for Europeans is not the existence of a post-American world, but an even bigger challenge is the way that the United States is trying to respond to its loss of power, which is essentially to turn its back on the European Union in search of partnerships with other powers. And that is having an enormous impact on the role of the European Union in America's strategic imagination, but also the way that we look at the rest of the world, because Europeans have traditionally looked at the world through a Western prism. And the fact that nobody in Washington looks at any problem through a Western prism actually creates quite a big change in the way that we have to deal with most of these challenges. And I also think that it has a particular impact on how we think about global governance, because we have been the biggest beneficiaries of the liberal order, which was set up by the United States after World War II. And we've had a faith-based approach that assumed that as other powers like China and India became richer and more developed, they'd have an increasing stake in the system and that had given them all this wealth and become responsible stakeholders. And now we're seeing increasingly that they're much happier free-riding on the existing system, trying to enlarge their own sovereignty, taking advantage of all the benefits of that system, whilst refusing to get sucked into the dirty business of supporting the order, which has benefited them so much. And I don't see a debate amongst the liberal powers about how you can uphold the bias in this order. In fact, in Washington, there's much more interest in looking at how you can come up with practical solutions to the day-to-day problems of today and tomorrow with some of these great powers. And part of the solution to that is kicking Europeans out of international institutions. The second way that I think power is shifting is within our own neighbourhood. And I think the TV coverage of the democratic wave that's working its way through the Middle East gives us a perfect illustration of the problem. On the one hand, it looks like 1989. But at the same time, we know that democratization and westernization, which were two sides of the same coin in 1989, are pushing in totally different directions. And that this democratic wave is about the emancipation of countries from the West. It's the final stage of decolonization. And that the countries that emerge will be free, but they will be much less Western and much less interested in us than the dictatorships that are being blown away. And what's happening in the southern neighborhood has its echo in the eastern neighborhood of the European Union. Ivan Krastev and I have recently written a controversial report called The Spectre of a Multipolar Europe, but we looked in that at how the unipolar, multilateral vision of a liberal, single liberal European order embodied in NATO and the European Union, where the rule of law, pooled sovereignty and interdependence gradually replace military conflict, the balance of power and spheres of influence, how that vision is running into trouble, largely because of some of the trends that other people have talked about, and Ivan talked about, particularly to do with Russia and Turkey and the withdrawal of the US to offshore balancing. And that means that we need to rethink how we deal with our neighbourhood, because that vision of a neighbourhood policy based on enlargement, never-ending enlargement, and of a single system which brought everyone in, I think it's something which has been one of the keys to the huge success of the last 20 years. I'm still a big supporter of the enlargement process for the Balkans, for Turkey. But as Tim pointed out, there are many countries that are around Europe that won't be in the European Union in the near future, and we need to think about how we can actually create a system for ensuring the order of our neighbourhood, which doesn't only have one tool in it, which is continuing enlargement to all countries in our space. And the third change, I think, is within the European Union itself. And in many ways, this has also been sped up by the financial crisis, which has accelerated a process which Alexander Smolar rather wonderfully called the decolonization of Germany. Creating the euro was supposed to tie Germany down to bind it more tightly to Europe. But in fact, what we're seeing at the moment is that it's had almost the opposite effect. It's put the rest of the European Union on a Procrustean bed where we have to voluntarily adapt ourselves to German expectations or be cut down to size by the markets. And as Germany has assumed this new role, it's disrupting many of the traditional structures that underpinned European integration, from, you know, traditional relationships like the Franco-German relationships, but to the very way that EU integration is done. Angela Merkel has spoken about the future of the European Union as being the union method rather than the community method. You're seeing the gradual sidelining of the European Commission. And this is also giving rise to strategies by other players to try and tame and channel German power. And I think for countries outside of the euro, like Poland and Britain, there is a particular danger of one of the unintended consequences of this being a two-speed Europe, where the gulf between the 17 and the 27 grows wider, which would have enormous implications for Europe's ability to have a common foreign policy in the world. So none of these processes are complete. I think they are all related to each other in that the shift in the global balance of power is also leading to a shift of power in the neighbourhood, and is one of the things which has actually made many in the German elite feel that they've outgrown the European Union. The fact that by the end of this year, Germany will trade more with China than with France is one of the reasons maybe why the elite is defining its interests in a different way. But this brings us back to Europe, and I just want to end by talking about how I think there is a real opportunity in this world for the European Union to play a different role, because the challenge is not one of resources. The European Union is still an incredibly powerful block on the world stage. It's the largest economic power in the world. It is responsible for 21% of the world's military spending, compared to just 5% for China, 3% for Russia, 2% for India, 1.5% for Brazil. We are the world leaders in development policy, as Tim was talking about. And many people have devalued the European Union because they've been gripped by what Amory Slaughter calls a Wall Street mentality, where in financial markets, people look at the flows rather than the stocks, and attention is naturally focused on the highest growth rates. But the European Union has very serious stocks. The question is, are we going to be able to use them? And I think this is really the biggest challenge for us, because in many ways, the next few years should be a world where Europe could thrive, because I think that we are entering an era where the core currency of power in the world will be economic rather than military. In 1990, Edward Luttwak wrote a brilliant article which argued that war between major powers would be off the agenda, and that the world would move from classical geopolitics to an era of geoeconomics. And he thought that the tools of geopolitics would change from military to economic tools, but that the goal of conflict between the big powers would remain the same. It was just that it would transfer itself to a different sphere. I think that his words maybe looked a little naive when Europe was collapsing into war in the Balkans and after 9/11, but the story which he set out then now looks like a very good description of the world in which we're living in. And though it's a complex world for the European Union to operate, because we have liberal economies and free markets, and IKEA and Nokia don't necessarily have the same relationship to the governments of their countries as Gazprom or Sinopec, it is still more promising, I think, for the European Union to be a superpower in a world which is governed by geoeconomic competition than one of classical geopolitical competition, and where the spheres of influence of the 19th century are the main way that you define and exercise your power. So the challenge, therefore, is whether we are able to rethink the way that we operate, how we manage our global relationships, how we manage our role within the neighbourhood, how we think about how we organise our domestic affairs, so that this incredible armoury and arsenal of power could actually be put to use in a more multipolar world, to project and to underscore and underpin some of the values that we take for granted within the European Union, which is a world which is governed by international cooperation, multilateral institutions, and the international rule of law. And I think that we do have the tools. The question is really whether we want to retire and slowly decline, or whether we can go out there and actually start to shape the world of the 21st century. And that's really why the European Council on Foreign Relations was set up.
Thank you. Would any members of the panel would like to react to what was said by other members of the panel, participants of the panel? If not, the floor is yours. I would just ask for very short questions, not long developments, because there's a lot of people and we are short on times. Please, where is micros? Oh, that's okay.
Bartłomiej Nowak, Center for International
Proszę
Relations.
Proszę o przedstawienie się.
Bartłomiej Nowak, Center for International Relations. Mark, I've read carefully. I must say it is fascinating to see your evolution of thought from the time when you wrote Why Europe Will Run the 21st Century until now. And I must say, it's spectacular on the level of analyze, but it should stop on the level of analyze. When you look for your Grand Bargain, you are closer to the Metternich era than... where are the countries in between Europe and Russia? What's their place? Thank you.
Thank you very much. The neighbor, please.
Leszek Jarzewski, editor-in-chief of Liberté magazine. I would like to ask you, is it possible in Europe to use a very basic economic term, economy of scale? We are talking about the crisis today, and all these numbers you're giving, that seems that, as it was said here, we are biggest potential superpower. And I strongly believe that there is no, if we can choose between the retirement and being a superpower, then perhaps retirement is a nice offer. But we don't have this choice. So either we become a superpower or we become an insignificant peninsula in the West, as was said by the Chinese leader in the past. And my question is here for you. Is it possible to use arguments in a political public debate that will argue for European reason of state, European raison d'etat? I think this is something we need today, because I'm a strong supporter of foreign policy. But foreign policy must be for something. And I think there is a time for your generation and our generation, I'm speaking on behalf of students, which I'm not already, that we define what we need this Europe for today. Because we needed it for peace, and we achieved peace. We almost integrated the continent. But we have some answers, and I would like to ask you, do you see a political prospect? Because we need political actors arguing, not in favor of nation-state interests, but in favor of European interests, and convince voters. And do you see it coming any time in the future? Thank you.
Thank you. Lady.
Karolina Wigura from Kultura Liberalna and Institute for Sociology, Warsaw University. Thank you very much for this wonderful discussion. I would like to ask a question about European citizen legitimization, meaning... talking to Christoph Bertram, I heard his opinion about the origins of the European Union. I think he's not alone in this diagnosis. He said, for the older generations of Europeans, it's quite clear that the beginning of the European Union is a trial to integrate Germany more into the European community, to make it more peaceful. But for the new generations of Europeans, this legitimization is quite abstract. They do not understand it. So what we are lacking today is a new point, a new center of legitimization for European Union, And this lack is affecting, in my opinion, the efficiency of Europe as a project on the world stage. Some of the remedia which were given by European intellectuals were, for example, referenda. Like, for example, Jürgen Habermas was saying that it would be important to organize European referenda. But we all know that they are absent. We don't have any referendas, except for these that are unsuccessful. So this is the question, not for any particular participant of the panel, but perhaps for all the participants, the question about legitimization for the new generations. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Please, gentlemen.
Maciej Pikiewicz, PhD, Warsaw School of Economics. Here was mentioned by the President and the Minister and other speakers the question of Africa. Therefore, I would like to ask a certain short question. I've been in Algeria, Senegal, and so on, but I would like to find out of your opinion the impact of the African Revolution on Europe. That is a certain question that I would like to ask the gentleman. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentleman behind here.
Tim Bose, German Historical Institute in Warsaw. I just would like to say that I think a better integration in foreign policy on the European level just works when we start a discussion about European citizenship. And I think these two discussions are pretty much related. And I think the discussion about the structure of European civil society is pretty much related as well with foreign policy issues. And there was another point I would like to criticize Mr. Sikorski, because you were talking about cultural incompatible countries, and I think it's just not the right term of talking about like different cultures in this way.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Gentleman there. Yeah.
From the Dutch embassy, but I wouldn't like to ask the question on behalf of the Dutch government, rather from my Indian perspective, as a person that was born in India. I think a lot of questions and issues that you mentioned are obvious for any Indian. India as a civilization state. My question is, I think in Europe we have a civilizations, but we don't have a state. Do you think we need to have a state in order to have this common foreign policy strengthened and et cetera? Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. There.
Łukasz Pawłowski, Institute of Sociology and Kultura Liberalna magazine. I want to introduce a bit more parochial perspective, and I have a question to Minister Sikorski about immigration policy, because you said that the better solution is to create the good conditions for the people who live abroad, and instead of taking them in, but creating good conditions for them there takes a lot of time, and it's not always successful, as we have seen. And I mean Poland as well, we need them now. And so my question is, would you advocate some change in Polish immigration policy, or would you let it stay as it is right now, which means non-existent or, yes, basically non-existent?
Thank you very much.
Marcin Święcicki. Actually, I have a few questions. One question is, you know, that following our predecessors, you know, that the current structure of taking decisions in Europe is very ineffective in view of the US, China, India, and very often small interests of some lobbyists are taking over the interests of Europe. But let me give you a few examples, you know. Sales of weapons to China against Taiwan and the democracy in Taiwan. The interests of the European farmers against Ukrainian agriculture. The EU is proposing a new trade agreement with Ukraine, but 5% of production is to be excluded, actually agricultural one, and Europe prefers to support our farmers, even the most ineffective, even in the mountains area, to pay high subsidies to them, instead of incorporating black soils in Ukraine, the most fertile soils Europe has, and to produce cheaper and more differentiated food for European consumer. Turkey. Why in Turkey the interest in integration with EU is just falling down and Europe is losing it? So I'm just, my question is whether you as this European Council, are you also thinking about the way of taking decisions in Europe? Because sometimes I see that, for example, European Parliament is much more closer to represent the interests of European citizens and somehow more has more vision than the small interests like I don't know, Ireland that can block all the Lisbon treaty. One small country with a small majority can block or not block. You know, we are waiting for this. So I'm just afraid that Europe in its internal structure is so inefficient that without reforming this, we will not be able to face all these challenges and to be a global player.
Marcin, could you pass to the gentleman there?
Paweł Hincza, graduate of Warsaw University and the College of Europe. I have two questions related to words spoken by Mr. Krastev and Mr. Sikorski. You said that Europe should avoid the status of commentator, should be like an actor. And Mr. Sikorski said that Europe should act as an imperial power. And I have a question, how Europe can act like this and avoid being a commentator if Europe, although has altogether 2 million soldiers, does not have like a military base in Bahrain and cannot influence the revolution there like US did. How can Europe influence revolution in Libya if like Italy refuses to accept some immigrants from Tunisia, for example, now, and Frontex acts like a barrier to Europe and not like a common European border guard? And how can Europe act like imperial power if it secures, as my predecessor said, interests of European agriculturalists, farmers, and refuses to sign a good treaty with Ukraine? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen here and afterwards.
Chciałbym zadać sobie pytanie w języku polskim, jeśli państwo pozwolę. Dotyczące pytania do pana ministra Sikorskiego. Ukraiński internet portal Obserwator. Polityka zagraniczna przyciągnięcia dyktatora Łukaszenki przez ostatnich 2 lata nie dała rezultatu. Usłyszeliśmy niedawno wyrok 4 lata opozycjonista, który uczestniczył w manifestacji wyborczej 19 grudnia. Takich wyroków będzie kilka, może kilkanaście. Jakie będą kroki Zachodu wobec białoruskiego reżimu i czy może białoruskie społeczeństwo oczekiwać jakichś sankcji ekonomicznych między innymi? Dziękuję.
Thank you. That's lady.
May I ask the question? Thank you very much. My name is Anna Skolimowska and I represent...
No, that's okay, but it's closer.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. My name is Anna Skolimowska, and I represent Cardinal Stefan Wyszyński University from Warsaw, and I would like to ask a question to Foreign Minister Mr. Sikorski. And this question is one more philosophical one, and the second is more practical one. So let me start with the philosophical one. In Europe, we've got a huge debate concerning the question whether it is still a community of values or only a community of interest. How can we answer this question in the context of European foreign relations? And this is this philosophical one, and the practical, I would like to know whether if the European Union Council for Foreign Relations was able to agree a common response for the Christian persecutions today on its meeting in Brussels. So thank you very much in advance for your kind question, answer. Sorry.
Thank you very much.
Bohdan Oppenheim, Loyola Marymount University, Los Angeles. Jak odwiedzam Polskę, wolę po polsku mówić. Ciekawi mnie...
But if you can speak in English...
Perfect. Yeah. I'm interested in the relationship between the Council, European Council for Foreign Relations, and the American Council. Do you see a certain degree of competitiveness there? Is there a strategy of cooperation? Are there any formal plans for links, for common conferences, debates, and so on? Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Very much. My name is Michaela. I'm a student of biochemistry. My question is on the future of U.S. Missiles and weapons in Europe. There is 200 nuclear weapons in Europe. What is your take on it?
Thank you very much. There, I can see a gentleman here.
Maciej Białek, Institute of Law and Administration, and I have two questions. One has already been mentioned. Well, among these goals or ideas here, you have fighting the global poverty. And my question is, can it really be done when the Europe agricultural market looks as it looks like now? And the second one is that, well, you mentioned here that in case of inefficiency of other means, Europe should be ready to use its military force in order to prevent genocides, not only in Europe, but among all the world. And my question is, how does it relate to the problem of North Korea? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, please.
Zbigniew Pisarski from Pulaski Foundation. I have a question to all the panel, maybe except Mr. Sikorski, because he might be maybe not comfortable answering this question. What is your opinion about the European Minister of Foreign Relations, so-called? Baronessa Catherine Ashton. What is your opinion about her qualifications and efficiency? And maybe we as a Europe, and as we are discussing today about foreign relations, select someone more competent, like Mr. Sikorski, or maybe Aleksander Kwaśniewski, or all the other statesmen. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I cannot see any more questions. Oh, there is one, the last one. Yes, please.
My name is Krzysztof Korzempa, and I've got two questions to Minister Sikorski. My first question is on behalf of many young people in Poland. Mr. Minister, you like talking a lot about human rights and citizen rights. One of the basic citizen rights is the right for an equal access to the job market, to the labor market, and employment. My question is, what do you think about nepotism and favoritism problem in Poland? And what is the scale of this problem in the public administration in our country? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We will close this part. Now, what? Somebody else? Yes, please. The last one.
Yeah, thank you. Wojciech Szybylski of Republika Nowa. My question is referring to, I believe, sort of what my colleague has been already asking. that the Europe, as you present it, unites only in a negative way, that is a response to some crisis. But do you foresee in the future a positive, a horizon for change, a positive horizon for Europe? And would that be a goal to seek one in the EC, FR? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now the member of the panels will answer in a reversed way, with one exception, Minister Sikorski, who must leave us, so he will be the first to answer the question. Please. Thank
you. I agree with the gentleman in the red jumper that nepotism is a very bad thing and that people should have fair access to jobs in the public sector in particular. That's why even when I was deputy minister over 10 years ago, I introduced the first open competitions to become heads of Polish institutes abroad, for example. And that's why we have created a civil service where a politician like myself doesn't decide the appointments in the civil service. I still have some influence in deciding the appointments to be ambassador, shared with the Prime Minister and the President. But as regards appointment in the civil service, it's always by competition, by law. Out of the three, but at the same time, a system has been created so that politicians can employ a couple of advisors, people close to themselves, that they can just appoint without this competitive system, so that they are not tempted to skew the appointment process in the civil service. And I believe most countries have that system. I think in the British system you have the civil service, but also the special advisor to the minister, one or two. Most ministers have these special advisors, which in the Polish system are called the political cabinet. And some people have up to 10 of such advisors. I have three. So out of the 3,500 people that I'm responsible for, there are three people that I appoint without competition. And this is because these are people that I trust, these are the people I want to work for them. And so these three people, yes, I have appointed by law on the basis of my personal judgment. Other than that, it's all competition. I hope that satisfies you. My assessment of Cathy Ashton, she gets better with every month, I have to say. She has an impossible job. She imagined to have to run the emergent foreign policy of 27 nations that you need to synchronize and represent, while at the same time having to create your foreign ministry from scratch. It's an impossible job, and we should give her every encouragement in it. And I have particular reasons to be pleased, of course, because you know, despite the hysteria in some sections of the Polish press, we now actually have a poll in the four-person directorate, which is now run by a Brit, a German, a Frenchman, and a Pole. So we have... We have reasons to be grateful to Cathy Ashton, and the very fact that there is now a permanent chairman of the Foreign Affairs Council is already making it work better, because we now have briefings on, for example, so if there is a discussion on Egypt, first you have the commissioner telling you what kind of money we are spending in Egypt, what our policy is. Then we have a discussion, then she sums up. It sounds straightforward and simple, but trust me, it wasn't always like that before. So I'd like to persuade you that it's better than before and getting better with every passing month. But I would like it to be remembered that when we chose the High Representative for the first time, I fielded a non-paper to the European Council, telling our heads of state and government to hold hearings, to have candidates, have hearings, and then to appoint someone, rather than do it by political fiat. My yardstick for the European Union is not a very ambitious one. I believe that the European Union should be no less democratic than the State of Vatican. And at the Vatican, as you know, they actually elect their head of state by a democratic vote, which we in the European Union don't. And it's a shame. As regards fighting global poverty and CAP, well, that's a big discussion. Agricultural prices have risen, so I do believe that there is less and less of an argument for maintaining agricultural prices and more for supporting the state of the countryside and improving the state of the countryside. And that's slowly, too slowly, but that's where the common agricultural policy is going, and I'm happy to say that we would have some vested interest in supporting the old CAP, but nevertheless, our agriculture minister and Poland supports the evolution of CAP in that direction. As regards using military power towards North Korea, steady on. We have conducted about 24 military operations as Europe, but they have been pretty small. We've done, and Poland has taken part in most of them. Congo, Chad, Somalia, off the coast of Somalia, Balkans. We don't even have an operations headquarters or a general headquarters because it's too controversial for some countries. So first we need proper planning and command and control facilities. And we'll probably have to go towards so-called reinforced cooperation, which means a coalition of the willing to achieve that. And even when we have that, it'll be many, I would say decades yet, before we are able to act globally, if ever. North Korea is an issue that the United States can't solve, let alone us. Poland actually has some residual role. We are a member of the Neutral States Supervisory Commission on the northern North Korean peninsula. When it was set up in 1953 as a result of the armistice, we of course were a neutral state. US nuclear weapons in Europe, what future for them? Well, let's not discriminate against the US nuclear weapons. There are some other tactical nuclear weapons in Europe as well, you know, and we don't even know how many there are, which is why Poland and Norway has proposed a non-paper, which has actually been accepted and digested by the NATO summit in Tallinn, namely that we should have a process first of transparency. We believe that Russia has at least 2,000 tactical nukes in Europe, at least, so 10 times more than the United States. And then if you care about removing nuclear weapons, at least from Europe, then surely the U.S. stock is a chip that we should use to get the Russian Federation to do its bit to rid in Europe of nuclear weapons. So it should be a process of first transparency, then confidence building, inspections and so on, and then possible removal out of Europe. So Poland is very much in favor of this process, but it has to be equivocal, it has to be mutual. Our friend from the Cardinal Wyszyński University asks us whether Europe is still a community of values. I think, yeah, but not necessarily the religious values. I mean, there are. I think we still believe in democracy. I wish we had made more of our strong commitment to the value of free speech during the crisis over the Danish caricatures, for example. Because actually that was an issue on which the church and civil society could act just like they did in Poland some decades ago, in unison, because we all care these days about free speech. So I think Europe has values, but they're post-religious mostly. As regards the persecution of Christians, now that's a different issue. When people are being murdered, and they are, and some countries are being cleansed of Christians, for example, in Iraq, the least that we can do is to say it, is to name the problem. I believe we should do much more. But trust me, we had trouble with Italy and a couple of other kindred countries to get others to even name the problem that there is persecution of Christians. I kept looking at my BlackBerry because I don't yet have a report from today's Foreign Affairs Council, so I don't know yet the answer to your question, whether we have come to a consensus or not. But I wasn't going to have a, and we, Franco Frattini and I said, if you're going to have a statement which is so cowardly as not to even mention Christians, then let's not have it at all. And so we're sticking out for a better one. Belarus, well, I'm very glad that I went to Minsk with my German colleague, because if we hadn't, today we could have been accused of not having tried every avenue in trying to civilize Lukashenko and trying to get him to obey European values. We made the extra effort. We went out of our way, risking criticism, because it's never nice for a politician to have a photograph with a dictator. You know, it always pursues you for years later. We knew the risks. We went out of our way and said, Mr. Lukashenko, have a free election, and here's a generous European offer. So we now, in clear conscience, can impose, and we have imposed, the toughest sanctions ever on Belarus because we were prepared to be so generous. And I think this is right. And if he goes further, we can go further too. How can Europe behave like a proper empire when we only have 2 million soldiers under our arms? I don't know, Mark can tell you in more detail, but I think Britain in its imperial height had, what, 100,000, 150,000 soldiers? If only 2 million soldiers were actually real soldiers, capable of being deployed somewhere, capable of being used. Europe accounts for over 20% of the world's expenditure on defense. And as a former defense minister, it just breaks my heart how little capability we get out of all this money. 2 million soldiers is a huge army. But when it comes to operations, sending a battalion is a problem, or a helicopter. And I don't mean Poland, I mean all of Europe. That's the real problem, that we spend so much money and get so little out of it. And of course you understand that I'm joking when I say a proper empire. We are very far from that. Is that all, or have I missed a page? Maybe just a couple of more. A gentleman from the German Historical Institute and Mr. Łukasz Pawłowski asked me about immigration and don't like my phrase, incompatible cultures. Well, to Mr. Pawłowski, I have this to say. You weren't listening to me very well. I was saying that this need for immigrants is, in my opinion, a myth. Is our saying we are unwilling to change our social spending, our behavior, our retirement age. Therefore, we need immigrants to pay for those luxuries. So it's not a necessity, it's a choice. It's a choice not to change our behavior. On current behavior, I agree, then mass immigration delays the day of reckoning. But as as the Chancellor of Germany, and I hope you you will allow me that I'm speaking somewhat in the vein of Chancellor Merkel and somewhat in the vein of Prime Minister David Cameron recently, who've said that multiculti has problems, okay? And we know that it does. Or at the very least, allow us to say that some costs follow, that mass immigration from linguistically and religiously different countries implies some costs, some even deferred by two or three generations, but they do exist. And so in this spirit of not being confined to the politically correct language and of speaking about actual problems that Europeans think about, I think this is the debate that we need to have. Because if we don't have it, the radicals have solutions. And they are ones that we don't like. So I defend my right to talk about the need for immigration and about shaping immigration. And as regards Poland, well, we have obvious sources of immigration if we decide that we need it. Number one, we would like to persuade our own young people to stay rather than leave. Number two, we would like the ones who have left to return. And number three, as a result of the 20th century, Poland has been moved around the map of Europe. So there are many people who are Polish who are beyond our borders, and if in the former Soviet Union, for example. And so what Germany did in the 70s and 80s by bringing Germans from the East, we could do too. And for us, that's the natural solution, because it also pays a historical debt that we have towards those people. Perhaps I should stop here.
Thank you very much, Minister.
Thank you.
Thank you for your participation. Mark Leonard now, please.
Thank you very much. I'm just going to pick off a few, either because they were addressed to me or because I have some things to say which maybe don't necessarily repeat things that other people have said beforehand, but I'm not going to try and answer all the questions. First question was about Europe's neighbours, and the backdrop is our report on the spectre of a multipolar Europe, and you very rightly said that the analysis in the report was on stronger ground than some of the policy recommendations. I think both Ivan and I and the other authors will stand firmly behind the analysis in the report, but we suggested that one of the ways of dealing with this new instability was to think about creating a trialogue between the European Union, Turkey, and Russia to talk about the big security problems facing our continent. And that is something which we express with much less confidence than the analysis. I think the problem that we were pointing to is very real, and that we do need to think of a way of developing a different relationship with these two emerging poles on the European continent. Personally, I'm very much in favour of Turkey joining the European Union, so are the other co-authors, but we're realistic that it's going to take a while for that to happen, and that in parallel with the negotiations, I think it does make sense for us to find new ways of talking to them. And with Russia, there is a new challenge of dealing with a post-BRIC Russia that is redefining its own foreign policy, and I think the Polish reset towards Russia is a good example of actually trying to change the relationship. Where does that leave the neighbours? I mean, the big challenge which we were trying to think about is how do we develop a modern way of dealing with a group of countries that have only recently regained their sovereignty, that are trying to create states, that don't want to be sandwiched between great empires and don't want to be treated as flyover space between the big capitals on the European continent. As Europeans, we believe in their right to sovereignty and their right to control their own affairs.
But the difficulty we have is that the only two models which people have used to think about them are the model of enlargement and enlarging the Cold War institutions like the European Union and NATO. And as I said, I'm a big fan. I believe in an expansive European Union. I want it to be as big as it can. But at the same time, not every single country on the European space is going to be in the European Union in the next 10 to 20 years time. So are there other ways that we can manage our relationships with them, even if only as a temporary phenomenon? But the other model, which I think is much more problematic than that, is going back to a 19th century concert of great powers where you carve up the continent between ourselves. And we don't want to... That, I think, is the thing which ultimately we have to avoid at all costs. So what we were trying to do in that report was to think about whether there are ways of creating order on the European continent which will allow the European Union to remain united and to work effectively, which will give a bigger role to Turkey, which will allow Russia to become post-imperial, and which will give these countries some kind of control and security as they develop their states and their identities. And the term which we use to capture that is the idea of a concert of projects. But how you express that in institutional terms is a very big challenge. Second question, which wanted to talk a bit about, is this question of legitimacy of the European Union. Because I think that it is a very real question, but that the answers which people have given to it have tended to be wrong, because people have looked at the European Union as a state in the making, and have therefore tried to give the EU legitimacy in the way that you give states legitimacy, by creating the European Parliament, having direct elections for MPs. Other people have talked for direct elections for the president of the Commission or the Council. We use basically 18th century political models to legitimate something which is not a state and never will be a state. The European Union is responsible for up to 50% of domestic legislation in the 27 member states that live within it. But it's the 50% that nobody cares about domestically. It's the 50% which they were happy to delegate to national technocrats, and which they're now trying to delegate to European officials who work with a series of national technocrats who make the decisions. And none of the issues which drive people to vote in national elections, and that's a difficult enough challenge, getting them to vote anyway, are actually been passed up to the European level. So if you ask people at the top five issues are in British politics, for example, it's always the same issues. It's the economy and taxation, it's the delivery of health, of education, and of various other public services. None of these things are done by the European Union. The European Union creates a regulatory environment which allows nation states and regional governments and local authorities to deliver these sorts of things. So if you ask people to go and vote in elections which don't affect those things directly, it's very difficult, which is why you end up with such low turnout in the European Parliament. So there are, and I think we have this kind of sad situation where, on the one hand, the European Union is becoming more and more technocratic, because people are scared of public opinion. And on the other hand, that's creating greater and greater populism, both at a national level and more anti-European parties as a reaction to the technocracy, which then drives the technocrats to become even more technocratic and hide their treaties even more and to run away from referendums. I'm not sure what the solution is, but I don't think it's either having referendums on issues which are too complicated for people to understand, like these catch-all treaties, which are designed to be very technical. And I don't think it's by giving more power to the European Parliament either. I wonder if it's about finding the issues which are really political and finding a way of having a proper debate about them. For example, when the euro was set up, there were some decisions which were made about the convergence criteria which have massive macroeconomic implications, and we're seeing the consequences of them at the moment. And that's something where there was never a political debate. But that was not something which was controlled by the European Parliament and which you could have done in the traditional way. Third question I was going to answer was about our relationship with the Council on Foreign Relations. We share a name with the Council on Foreign Relations. We haven't got a formal association with the Council, but we do work with all sorts of think tanks all over the world, with big Chinese think tanks, with Russian think tanks, and with American think tanks. We haven't so far worked with the Council, though we have worked with Brookings Institution and other kind of big American think tanks, as well as think tanks all over Europe. And so that's very much part of the way that we work. We want to work with partners everywhere. Maybe just two more questions. One's on Cathy Ashton. And I share very much the comments which your foreign minister started out with, which is that I think she has an impossible job. But I think that the real test of whether she is going to work and whether the institution is going to work is unfolding in front of us on the televisions at the moment. I think that the thing which defines leaders and statesmen and women are events and the way that we rise up to them. It wasn't until the Kosovo crisis erupted that Tony Blair went from being an ordinary politician to thinking of himself as a global statesman. It wasn't until 9/11 that George Bush became the political figure that we all came to appreciate so much between 2001 and 2008. And I think that this really is the moment which is going to define whether the European Union is serious. Because you don't really know whether somebody, what someone counts for until they're willing actually to take some risks and to lose some things. And the battles that she's had so far with the European Parliament about the exact makeup of the External Action Service and with the member states about how many Polish or British or French people you had in the service were not the sorts of battles of which history is made. But I think what is unfolding in front of us in North Africa at the moment, in an area where the European Union has enormous resources and an area which has an enormous ability to affect our welfare, that is the stuff which will define whether the EU is a serious player in our region and therefore whether we can be a serious player in the world. And I think the circumstances which she faces are very difficult, with the vested interests of the different member states, the toxic historical relationships, a legacy of mistrust that has come about as a result of failing policies towards that region over a generation. But if she somehow manages to create a framework which will bring the huge power and the resources and the idealism of Europe's citizens and governments behind it, then I think, you know, we could see something serious emerging from that. And that brings me to the last answer which I wanted to make, which was about negative and positive integration. You asked whether the EU will only ever unite in response to crisis or whether there can be a positive vision for the EU. Well, I'd be quite satisfied if the EU unites in response to crises. I mean, historically, that has been the driving power of the European project. There's a beautiful quote from Paul Valéry who says that we hope vaguely, we dread precisely. And I think that, in a way, encapsulates the philosophy behind the European Union from the beginning. It was an escape from history. It wasn't designed around a beautiful vision of the future. But history was powerful enough and the crises were powerful enough to drive the most remarkable and exciting geopolitical experiment in 500 years. And the worry now is not that we will only respond in response to crisis. The worry is that the crises are actually going to overwhelm us and that we won't respond. We will retire. We'll step aside. And as the euro crisis started to erupt, that was what terrified me and many other people. I actually think that we are going to respond to crises, but let's not underestimate the difficulty of simply responding to crises and turning crises into a battle cry for the future of Europe.
Ivan, you're.
We have reached the moment in the discussion in which the answers are going to be judged not on how good they are, but how brief they are.
So this is why I'll try basically to combine all my answers around three questions, and many of the things that Mark said basically I agree with. The first is how not to be a commentator, and basically it comes very much also to the Ashton story. Probably they're going to be too much on a kind of common position here, is, but she's not charismatic, which is quite obvious. On the other side, there is a kind of an attempt very much to underestimate. This was true for Merkel. Do you remember 1 year after Merkel came to Germany? This was a talk that Germany cannot have leadership anymore, that it's going to be a weak chancellor, all these comparisons with Kohl and others. I do believe that what Ashton is doing is basically the Chinese strategy of the peaceful rise. If you're going to come with a very strong person playing European Union foreign minister, he's going to be killed on the 6 months. Because neither of the big states are going to enjoy this. So from this point of view, you are obtaining power pretending how weak you are. And I do believe that Ashton is good at this. Secondly, I do believe that she's also quite good on something different, and this is coming with priorities and phrasing things in the way they're going to work for her. External service, neighborhood, but also strategic partnerships, basically understanding that European Union never can act on its own. The basic problem is with whom, what kind of problem you're going to decide. And here comes my comment on how not to be basically a commentator. Commentators are famous for three things. First, that they're commenting on everything. Secondly, that they're very much putting on brilliance and not basically want to be done. And thirdly, that their basically silence is meaningless. If a commentator is not going to say something about anything, you know that simply he was sick this week. I do believe part of the problem of the European Union is that we are trying to pretend of being global power, as a result of it we're making statements about things on which we don't have any leverage. I don't know how much money we're spending on Pakistan. I don't have the feeling that European Union is a very powerful player there. If this is the case, one is constrain yourself. Speak where you believe that you have resources and interests there, but speak powerfully. Because let's give you one example. At the same time, when in Egypt there have been people on the streets and there were people killed, there have been also demonstrations in Albania where 4 people have been killed. I do believe that Albania is a place where European Union should speak very powerfully. Because if you're not going to do anything in Albania, what matters what you're saying about Egypt? And I do believe this type of kind of even body language of European Union makes sense. Secondly, I don't believe it's only about one institution. Till now, European Union always has three modes of leadership. One was through the Commission, and during the enlargement, it was very clear. The second was when the bigger member states played a role like the EU-Iranian task. And the fourth was one of the most interesting country lead. And this was the case, for example, of the Polish leadership during the Ukrainian Revolution. I do believe that with the new European Union policy on Russia emerges a fourth type of models which I find extremely fascinating. And this is two countries which are very much concerned but have a different points of view of where the problem stands, what was the case with Germany and Poland, converging their positions and leading. Because there are some issues on which Europe is divided, and only the countries which really have been in an opposite position can come together. And I do believe from this point of view, I see much more the Polish change of mind with respect to Russia, not so much of Poland basically trying to evaluate differently the reality in Russia, but understanding that Russia's weakness can be as threatful as Russia's aggressiveness. And from this point of view, this type of a role of the strategic debate makes sense. This is why having a common strategic debate is so important. And from here, I'm moving to the problem of the narrative and all this. Do we need a normative vision, or basically we can overcome crisis? Honestly speaking, I never believed that there was a plan for Europe. Plan of Europe is the way we're telling the story of overcoming crisis when they're over. European Union looks as a realization of plan when you look backwards, but not when you look forward. But the major problem here is different. Foreign policy people normally are not interested in domestic politics. But what is changing in Europe very much is domestic politics. And it has a lot to do with the highest level of mistrust to the political, business, cultural elites. There is a new populist condition in Europe. And exactly because the foreign policy is the domain of the elites, it's very difficult to bring people together.
And I do believe that one of the things that we are not doing very much is first doing this, and secondly trying to understand that there is a new very important political actor emerging. And this is what I'm going to call a threat on majorities. You have a political or ethnic majorities in the countries, which because of their demographic imagination start to behave and feel like minorities. They believe that they are shrinking. They basically have the feeling that they don't have the power over societies that they run. Just to give you one figure. In the United Kingdom, there was a question being asked to the Englishmen and basically to foreigners. Do you believe that you can influence the policy of your government? Only 21% of the Englishmen declared that they believe that they can influence. 38% of the foreigners, immigrants, those not being born there. Of course, it's not the factual situation. There are two breeds here, but I do believe that Englishmen still have some say on their policy. But because of the trend, you have this, and I find this extremely kind of a interesting but real and dangerous development, which can shape very much the way we're talking about foreign policy. And here I'm going to my last very short point on immigration. If Europe is divided between East and West, this is not because of many other things, even not so much because of legacies, but because of the fact that Western Europe is very much an immigrant Europe and Eastern Europe still lack immigration. Especially we lack immigration which is not coming from the traditional region. I do believe in the next 10 years, Poland is slightly younger, but places like Bulgaria, for example, on the demographic profile, we are worse than Italy, if you can imagine this. And as a result of it, there are going to be a flow of immigrants. We don't have a culture how to do with this. We don't have a sense of guilt because we have never been a colonial power. We don't have much sense of solidarity. If people believe that the Roma are the worst treated parts of our societies, the latest survey in Bulgaria showed that the imagined immigrants from China and Vietnam, whom we didn't see yet, are even most rejected than the Roma. And this fear of the unknown, in my view, is going to be a major political factor. And this is going to happen exactly on this type of outskirts of Europe. And this, in my view, is going to be, in a certain way, the major challenge for Central and Eastern Europe. And from this point of view, when Minister Sikorski said, let's speak not politically correct, multiculturalism is dead, I don't know exactly what is dead and what is alive, but how the real alternative looks like. What else are you going to do? Are we going to shoot all these people coming from Tunisia and Egypt? How exactly are you going to stop them, especially if Mr. Gaddafi is not there to put them in a camp? So from this point of view, I do believe rhetorically it's much more easy to solve the problem than politically.
Thank you very much. Tim.
Thank you. Well, as someone once remarked, we've reached that point in the evening when everything has been said, but not yet by everybody. So I shall try and outdo Ivan Krastev on the Krastev criteria and just answer one question, but a large one. But before doing that, let me just say that when the minister said, I rather like this, that the EU should be no less democratic than the Vatican, it does occur to me that the Vatican has a somewhat restricted electorate. We do have a female high rep, after all. It may be some little time before we get a female Holy Father. Now, the question I wanted to answer came from Cultura Liberalna, and thank you for the emails that you send me so regularly, which is about legitimation. And this is the central question. Clearly, what story is it that we have to tell about this project? And for 50 years, although it was a project of the elites, Europe had overwhelming legitimacy. And if you look at the pro-European argument in every European country, they're very different in many ways, but they all have the same form. We have been in a bad place. That bad place could be Nazism for Germany, occupation for France, relative economic decline for Britain, communist dictatorship for Poland. We had plenty of bad places in the European past. And we want to go to a better place, and the name of that better place is Europe. And you know this very well in Poland, because that was a classic shape of your pro-European argument. The problem, comes when we're all in it, when we're all in that better place, when we're all in that Europe, and we begin to take it for granted. And that, I believe, is the problem of success that the European Union has at the moment. And it amazes me that even in post-communist Europe, even in Latvia or Estonia or Lithuania, states that did not exist on the map of Europe 20 years ago, people kind of take it for granted. That you live in a free country, that on Friday afternoon you can jump into a plane and fly to Lisbon for the weekend. So that actually forgetting, the speed of forgetting, is part of the problem of legitimation. But that's no longer going to do the job. Global warming does not do the job either. It's not a mobilizing threat like the Red Army in the center of Europe. The rise of China doesn't do the job either. It's not like the Red Army on your own streets. There is no immediate mobilizing threat, and that's our problem. How would I make the case? I would make it in terms of what you mentioned, our citizens. I would say, people, to defend just the level of freedom we have achieved, the quality of life we have achieved, the level of social justice we have achieved, to defend our values, we really need to get our act together. Because if we don't, we will have less freedom, a worse quality of life, a smaller pension, a weaker welfare state, less social justice, and our own values will be in decline. Because I think there is that point about the issues of multiculturalism and immigration, that there is a set of values which I would identify with a certain post-Christian, post-Enlightenment culture of Europe, which are under threat, let's not kid ourselves, and that is why we need to get our act together to defend our liberal values, our freedoms, and that's why we need a European foreign policy. And last point, this is not raison d'état, a European raison d'état, because there is no European état, and there will not be, at least in my lifetime, I suspect not even in yours, nor do we need one. We don't need the United States of Europe to do what we need to do. Actually, the diversity of our states, which is the great glory of Europe, can also be an advantage. You'll remember from classical mythology the image of the Hydra-headed monster. What we have the chance to be is to be a benign Hydra, which realizes common purposes with 27 different heads, all looking slightly different and doing it in slightly different ways. 27 plus one heads, because there's also the EU head. And that's what where we need to get, is to be that benign Hydra telling this new story about defending the basic freedoms and rights and quality of life of our own citizens. And I hope you in Poland will join us on that journey. Thank you.
Marty, you are the first, and quite naturally you will close our debate.
First of all, I have listened to my colleagues. We have been listening to each other on many occasions, and I must say that I enjoyed every time as much as I have done tonight. Few comments, nevertheless, and they are my reaction not only to some of the questions, but also what my colleagues said, because I want to continue the debate with them as well. Mark, when you said that we are living in a post-Western world, I think we have to, it's a good debating point, but I think we have to define what do we mean. Because if you look what is happening in Middle East and North Africa at the moment, if I have understood, and I have been watching TV lately because of various reasons more than I normally do, what are these people wanting? They want to have the universal values, the democratic values which are important for us. I think it depends very much how we handle this whole process of change. I don't think, and I agree with what Timothy was saying about the that we don't, the nature of EU. We don't want to become an imperial power. I think we are looking cooperation among the democracies of this world. And I was hoping that when one looks at the successful exercise of enlargement, when, for instance, Poland joined the European Union, I would think that countries who went through this process are the best ones to assist those countries who are actually going through these processes, provided they want our assistance. So I see a role for Poland and many other countries in this. A friend of mine about the Germany, when this was discussed, a friend of mine recently said to me that perhaps the way to keep Germany interested in EU is that the rest of us have to start behaving more like Germans. And I perhaps he was referring to the fiscal discipline of a society. But I leave this thought with you. Then I already answered the effect of the African Revolution on Europe. Immigration policy. I have participated when George Papandreou was foreign minister. I joined him on a number of meetings on immigration policy for EU. He was very courageous at that time to take those issues up. And I think we badly need to discuss a proper immigration policy. I say in my own country where the demographics influence the future to a very large extent, that I don't see a bright future for my country. We are a Finnish and Swedish-speaking country mainly. Some people in the north speak Sami. But if I compare us to Canada, for instance, where two international languages are offered for the best brains in the world, I think even if our climates are more or less the same, I think Canadians obviously have an advantage. I see a bitter competition among us, among 27 of us in a long term. And let's be prepared for that and have a civilized immigration policy, because we can't manage without that. There was a very important question about the values and interests. Who was the person who... Yes, the lady over there. This is an issue that I think bothers all of us who have to make decisions, because it's a continuous fight. How do we get a civilized balance between our interests and our values? Because we can never believe that you could only make your decisions on the basis of values and forget your interests. But I think there is a civilized way of combining these two. And perhaps that's the best answer I can give to you, that perhaps we have to aim, and all of us who are interested in that the values are not forgotten, have to emphasize that. On the gentleman from Los Angeles, I don't think we ever saw any competitive attitude towards the American Council. At one stage, I and my colleagues remember it as well as I do, that when we decided that we would be called the European Council on Foreign Affairs, we were a bit hesitant whether our American cousins would sue us for using the name. But it was European Council on Foreign Relations. It shows that there was enough cooperation. And in the future, I think we see, as Mark was saying, we see much more possibilities for joint action on a number of things. Europe as a negative image. Bear with me. the younger ones in the audience, I'm 73 now. As long as I remember, I have been traveling in my profession 150 to 200 days a year. I still remember when, as a UN employee, I was traveling from New York via London to Africa, to Southern Africa. And I was dealing with Namibia particularly, from 77 to 1990. And I remember when I went to London and to immigration. And I never forget that there was a sign, aliens, which I was supposed to take. I must say that I like it much more when I can now go EU citizens. It makes an enormous difference, but perhaps for a simple reason that I'm sentimental and old. But the mere fact that particularly UK is not part of Schengen, Schengen, Euro, what a difference it has made for us who travel as much as I do. So it's much easier to accept the fact that yes, we are Europeans. And I remember when I stayed for 13 years in New York when I worked for UN. It was a continuous service then. I must say that I didn't feel so much Finn. I felt perhaps even more Nordic, but even more I felt that I was a European. And so did my wife. So Europe has meant, and as Timothy Carter Nash was explaining, that we take easily granted all these positive developments that have taken place during the last 20 years. It's a remarkable change and a positive change. But let's be critical. I have to confess, and this is not terribly patriotic comment to end my presentation, that when the Newsweek came to the conclusion that my country was the best place in the world to live, when I saw that, I turned to my wife and said, how lousy are the others? For the simple reason that I was not underestimating all what we had achieved in my society. But if we would start thinking in Finland that we are living in a heaven, that there's nothing more to improve in our society, and there was a reference by him about the gender equality in certain circumstances. That's an area as well where we are not an ideal place, whatever we say. We are better than most, but not as good as we should be on these issues. So there are a number of issues that we have to become better. And if we think of European power, I think then we should not forget that we have to be able to provide our youngsters the best education in the world if we want to survive. And I think let's concentrate on those issues when we discuss. We should not forget this, because if we don't do, we will not be a leading influence, positive influence in the world. Not a power, but leading influence in the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Just three short remarks to end up our discussion. First, I would like to thank you very much, Mrs. Rector, Professor Katarzyna Hałaśnińska-Macugow, who welcomes us here at the University of Warsaw and accept our meeting to take place here. The second remarks, this is, I explained at the beginning why we organize debate on a very general subject, Europe and the world. There is another private reason was why I suggested it. Many years ago, a friend of many of us, Bronisław Geremek, wrote a brilliant article exactly on the subject. The situation was very difficult. He was one of the founder of the CFR. So in a way, this is also homage to Bronisław Geremek. And the third remark is directly related to the problem of Vatican as an ideal. Professor Magda Schroda, a friend of mine, and Professor Płatek interrogated me why there are only
men here on the panel. And my answer is that this is unfortunate that there, Emma Bonino, who is eminent member of the board of ECFR, and here are only people, this is connected with the meeting of the board of ECFR. He was supposed to participate in the debate. Unfortunately, for political reasons, she couldn't come. But still, the problem of Vatican and the problem of the democratic policy where the woman can be president is posed, certainly. Thank you very much. This is what I wanted to say. I hope this is not the last, certainly this is the last, not last meeting, even big meeting organized by ECFR here. Thank you very much to panel and to you all. Thank you.